Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I wanted to begin by noting that this is the 75th broadcast in our series, so I wanted to take a moment to thank you, our listeners. We're pleased to mark this milestone with a true world-class IT leader, Google CIO, Ben Fried. At Google, Ben oversees global technology systems for one of the premier technology companies in the world. Prior to joining Google, Ben spent more than 13 years in Morgan Stanley's technology department, where he rose to the level of managing director of application infrastructure. During his time there, he led teams responsible for software development technology, web and electronic commerce technologies and operations, and technologies for knowledge workers. Prior to his time at Morgan Stanley, Ben helped design and develop the decision theoretic scheduler for Heuristocrats Research under contract to NASA. It was used by NASA scientists to schedule missions for their orbital observatories. Ben has a bachelor's degree in computer science from Columbia University. I recently caught up with Ben in his office in New York City, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 2, infrastructure, as Ben spoke about his thoughts regarding cloud computing and collaborative technologies and their implications for Google, Principle 3, project and portfolio management, as Ben detailed the processes used to prototype and more broadly release technology products for internal, consumer, and business customers, Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as Ben spoke about his interactions with Google's famously tech-savvy colleagues, as well as a variety of other topics. Ben Fried, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Oh, thanks. Great to be here.
Excellent. Of all the interviewees we have had on the forum, I think this is the one where I believe all of our listeners have used your services in one way, shape, or form. What might be a little bit less familiar to our listeners is the role of the CIO within Google. I wonder if you could take a moment to talk a little bit about your role within the organization.
Oh, thanks a lot, Peter. It's a great question. You know, the capsule summary of my role is my organization provides technology services for Googlers. So that's everything from the personal computing technology that they use and all the support of it to software that powers our finance and HR and legal and supply chain, for example, departments, to the people who integrate newly acquired companies into Google, to video conferencing, voice communications. It's quite a long list, but if you think of it as technology services consumed by people who work at Google, that's probably a good way of thinking about it. And I also appreciate your asking this question because I do get a lot of random postal mail from people asking me to do things like fix their search results, and I actually don't have the ability to do that. I'm sorry, my mom's probably disappointed if she's listening to hear that, but FYI.
That's good to know, although I'm a little bit disappointed as well. I had a couple of follow-up questions after our interview, but... can you talk a bit about some of your priorities for the year ahead?
Yeah, sure. So I kind of think there's a class of priorities I have that are maybe uniquely Google and ones that I think may be pretty resonant with other senior IT people who might be listening to this. But let me share kind of both categories. The first off, I would say in the, you know, you may have a priority like this in your organization category. I'd say, you know, number one, the first thing I'd list is we're doing a lot of work iterating on governance models, right? What's the best way of partnering with our clients? What's the best way of expressing and managing their priorities? All great IT departments work on this kind of constantly, right? And we definitely are as well. You know, secondly, and then in that same category, there is a ton of super important project work going on in our major constituencies that we need to support. You know, some of it is legal and supply chain and finance and HR all have really important initiatives, and their initiatives are just as important to us as anything that comes out of our minds as well, right? We are all about enabling Google and enabling the business. So I think every CIO would give you lists kind of like that. Some of the things that are going on that are uniquely Google, and first and foremost, I would say, is we spend a lot of time thinking about what we do to enable growth of the company, right? The footprint is growing, the employee count is growing, our software, our services are experienced by every person in the company and are key to bringing people into the company. And so thinking about what we do to do that and make that as fast, as efficient, as great a process as possible, we spend a lot of time on. How do we help the company grow? I'm also spending a lot of time now, it's an organizational priority, working on how to engage with the open source community, right? And this is all about, are we open sourcing enough of what we do? It's less about how we consume open source, for which there's a great, Google has a great kind of reputation and great citizenship in the open source community, but thinking about how we work with the open source community and kind of reflect and express what we do and whether we're open sourcing the right things and so on. And then related to that, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about how we share, how we do IT at Google with a broader community. We are, by our very nature, we take full advantage of all of Google's products and services. And there's a great story to be told there about how companies, sophisticated, large global companies, can use the products and services really well. So I'm spending, it's a priority of mine, a priority in my organization to be transparent and clear about how we do that.
That's great. Following up on the point of open source activities,
yeah.
It seems a real philosophy within Google revolves around open standards.
Right.
This is evident in the Android operating system, which as compared to iPhone's OS is the open one that anyone can develop applications for and so on. But it also applies to the so-called 20% time, allowing people within Google to spend a significant chunk of their time working on whatever they choose to. And this sort of innovative culture has its tremendous advantages. But I would imagine from a CIO's perspective, it comes with some disadvantages, maybe too strong a word, but at least some complexity that one must take some time to grapple with. What are your perspectives on that?
So it's certainly true. It creates a bunch of questions that you need to answer, although in all honesty, they're questions I've seen previously as well. I think that the first observation, the one that I think is really great, is that because Google treats virtually all the software development that's done at Google gets treated as internally as in a way very much like open source projects. Almost every engineer at Google can look at the source code of almost everything going on in the engineering department of which my organization is a part. And I think that kind of leads to a great thing, right? We believe in transparency. Transparency leads to quality. It creates better products, better work. I think for me as a CIO, it means you need to think on your feet. You can't hide behind walls of not showing people what you do or how you work, and it means you need to be responsive. I think it's also really, it's a great thing to realize that Google engineers can look at, contribute to, comment on what's going on in my organization. Google software engineers, right? That's pretty cool. What I was alluding to earlier is that I think every CIO grapples with the fact that technology comes into their organization that they didn't originate. And in my case, that technology is coming in from great software engineers and brilliant Google technologists. Yeah, that's hard. I don't think it's harder than the problem that CIOs or IT people have about technology coming in through other means as well, right? The big advantage is it's the products of great engineers. It's also great that through things like 20% time, people can contribute to my people's projects or can come up with projects themselves that may actually influence people. There are some products that we use that my organization owns now that didn't originate inside the organization and are absolutely key to all kinds of important processes here at Google. So there are great successes of this internal openness model and 20% contribution. Difficult to deal with, but it's not a unique problem by any means.
How do you, and I realize it's probably a difficult question to come up with a succinct answer to, but how do you think about standards? How do you think about, so in that environment where people are dreaming up ideas that may or may not comply with standards of the organization, how do you think about applying, or not, as the case may be, some sort of corporate standard, which in some ways may limit the degree to which somebody might pursue one avenue versus another?
So that's a really good question. You know, I'd say, first of all, everything, because we're part of engineering, there's a broader set of engineering standards about how software is written, about how the work is reviewed, you know, even about things like the quality of the security tools that you use to, and the application performance. You know, there's broader engineering standards at Google for how stuff has to work, and we can take advantage of all of that, right? And then, honestly, if you look at the diversity of technologies within my organization, you know, we're operating pretty broadly across the spectrum of alternatives inside Google anyway. You know, sometimes we can find the case that someone's occasionally, there's maybe one app I can think of, the case where someone wrote a really useful app in a language that my people don't generally work in. And the answer is now, actually, I have some people working on adopting the app, and they're thinking about, do they port it? Do they extend it in the language it's written in? Whatever. But in general, working within the context of broader engineering standards at Google served us pretty well.
That's wonderful. Google historically, or maybe originally, certainly made its name as a leader in consumer applications, mm-hmm. but in recent years has developed quite a position in enterprise applications. And I've been intrigued to learn more about the relationship between those two. A prominent example being Gmail, of course, mm-hmm. which was solely a personal application, a consumer application, but now has become a very prominent corporate application as a lot of organizations have switched their email to be hosted by Gmail. I'd love to hear a bit more about how the organization thinks about that translation of consumer products that then become enterprise products. Is that something that's thought of from the get-go? Are all consumer products potential enterprise products in some way? Is there a natural path the organization follows?
So every application story is a little different. And I should preface this by saying I'm not on the enterprise team, and I would not intend to speak for the enterprise team or one of the consumer products teams. But there's an important phenomenon taking place in the IT landscape in general, which is the corporatization of consumer technologies, right? And I think that these Google products that you just mentioned and the Google AppSphere domain suite are great examples of enterprises being able to harness innovation done originally to solve consumers. It's an incredibly important and new thing. It's difficult for us to deal with because, I mean, honestly, as IT people, we're used to telling the vendors what we want and how software should work and what it should do. You know, whereas this software comes from a very different perspective. It comes from the perspective of having to succeed in the consumer landscape, in a place where people can choose among whatever tools they want to use. The winners in the consumer landscape are ones that have unique economics of scale and of cost and of self-supportability and of generally one in a freer marketplace than most enterprises can afford to entertain. And so having the winners in those marketplaces now appear as corporate offerings is this great thing because your users are already familiar with them in general, right? Which means that your support costs tend to be lower, which is really an important thing when you consider that support costs tend to dominate, you know, over acquisition costs in most IT purchases, right? Secondly, there's this element of being able to tap into enormous economies of scale. The cloud, Google's offerings in particular, is all about creating consumer offerings on a platform that has enormous, enormous economies of scale. In order for these to be effective technologies that can be effectively paid for with ad revenue, for example, out of ad revenue, the costs of operating them are very, very low. And that's great for us as CIOs because it allows us to reset the bar on what the ongoing costs of our software offerings to our internal users should be in many cases. So I think corporatization of consumer software is this incredibly important thing. It's kind of how we live and breathe. To answer your question, I don't know of any case where you couldn't consider a consumer offering ultimately for enterprises. I mean, some things that just kind of seem it might make sense or might not, but that's definitely what the enterprise team is here to, it's what they're here to do.
Well, you mentioned the cloud, Ben, and I wonder if you could take a moment to talk a bit more about that. Obviously, it's a hot topic with a lot of CIOs these days, and Google has a big share of this currently. A lot of what it's doing with enterprise applications is done through the cloud. Can you talk a bit about how you think about that?
Sure. And I think, unfortunately, the cloud is such a great term. It's being used by lots and lots of different entities to describe what are ultimately different things. But here's fundamentally what I think is different about the cloud. It's about economies of scale that didn't exist as a result of service providers operating in scales that didn't exist. There's a stat that the enterprise team uses, which is a number of years ago, I don't remember, 4 years ago, something like that, 5 years ago. You know, Google makes its own servers. We've announced that publicly. We design and build our own servers. And 4 or 5 years ago, we were the fourth largest server manufacturer in the world for a customer of one, ourselves. That's an economy of scale. When it makes sense for you to build these enormous custom-built data centers with custom-designed, self-manufactured servers in them, you're operating on a scale with economic opportunities available to you that just aren't available to smaller players, even if the smaller players are themselves large organizations with enormous IT budgets. So first of all, the cloud is about getting access. What's different about the cloud is about getting access to those economies of scale, which allow you to do computing, do IT in ways that were previously unavailable, cost levels that were previously unavailable. I think secondly, when you look at, there's a natural hierarchy of sophistication of offerings in the cloud marketplace. I'd say that, first of all, you have to understand that there's a lot of companies that want to say, use phrases like the cloud inside your data center. And I think in many cases they may be talking about great products, but based on what I just said about these economies of scale, there isn't really such a thing as a cloud inside your data center. You can work on getting better utilization of your existing internal resources, but that's not the cloud. What is the cloud, I think, fundamentally, what are the cloud opportunities and maturity, how you should think about approaching the cloud is there's one very basic level, which is, can I use a cloud provider to give me access to hardware I don't have to buy myself, right, and get dynamic scale, for example, and turn what was previously a set of CapEx activities into OpEx activities. It's a great thing. It's not a bad place to start. It's better off than having to buy all the stuff yourself in many cases, if you can do it. There's a higher level offering that you see some cloud providers offer, which is not just giving you some remote equivalent of bare metal, but giving you a managed operating system instance. So now you don't need to worry so much about having your own system administrators for every service you're offering in the cloud. Someone else is taking care of managing an operating system for you. And then the levels above that, I think, kind of make themselves clear as well. There are cloud offerings that mean maybe you don't need to have your own database administrators, or you don't need to have your own application administrators, or you don't have to actually manage and host your own applications. I think each one of these is kind of a higher level value that allows you to stop worrying about a broader class of problems that were previously inside your organization. They're now services that you can get on demand. And where you start, you know, which one of those levels you start at and where you end at depends an awful lot on what your needs are, but they're all great opportunities, and they all fundamentally allow you to change, take advantage of these new macroeconomic economies of scale.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting insights. And I think I'm hearing you say that there are org structure implications to one's decision related to the cloud. You're talking about a lot of potential positions that were quite prominent in days past that may be less prominent in days in the future. Does that translate into an IT department that has a greater share of people who are focused on quote-unquote strategic activities as opposed to commoditized activities?
It's a really deep question. It's a great question. I think that I would imagine most people are in technology because they like the fact that it's an always changing landscape. I certainly love it because it's changing so much and it's always reinventing itself. You know, there's a piece of advice that I've often offered to new managers and new executives, which is that what you did that got you into the seat you now sit in isn't the thing that you need to do to be successful in that seat. And it's worth reiterating that when you think about these cloud opportunities as well. There is a vital role for IT in every organization that has it. And what that reflects is the fact that there is a unique fusion of deep understanding of technology with deep understanding of your organization's business and mission. And that fundamentally is where IT needs to be, is at the fusion of technology and organizational mission and deep understanding of your organization. The roles within your IT department and the skills needed are going to change over time. It's really important to think about hiring generalists, not specialists, because technology landscape is constantly changing. I still think that having software development capabilities is always going to be an important part of every IT shop in some way, because it's only through custom software development that you can really differentiate your organization. And I mean differentiate in the broad sense, not competitive differentiation, but also cultural differentiation as well. How you make your company different can more often than not be done with custom software than anything else. And understanding that that's kind of one of the arrows in the quiver of the CIO is still incredibly important. Other than that, I think you need openness and generalists and people who can adapt to change, because that's what IT is all about.
That's great. Another hot topic these days is collaborative technologies, Ben. I wonder if you could take a moment to talk about your perspectives on that and Google's role in collaborative technologies, more generally speaking.
So, you know, it's interesting. Google is one of the first companies that, the first post-internet companies, I guess is how I heard someone, I don't remember who, describe it. And I think that, you know, that assumption of connectedness goes into everything that the company does. In fact, you know, what we've seen is that it, what's compelling about the applications that we build, for example, is the collaborative tools built in. It's often what we've learned looking at how Google Apps is used by Googlers, that was built to solve problems that Google themselves had, ourselves had, since we were, as often as not, our own guinea pigs in it, is that collaboration comes first. Getting the collaboration right, understanding the connected universe we operate in, the feature set follows from that. The first thing is enabling the workforce to collaborate with itself. Now, there's all kinds of interesting and very, very different examples about what that collaboration should mean. Some of it has to do with the feature set of Google Apps. Some of it has to do with, for example, the direction that products like Google Talk is taking, right? Or it's got video chat. You know, we've got a video conferencing room here that's built on top of Google Talk, right? And built on top of off-the-shelf consumer technologies. And using Google Talk, it works definitely. My organization is experimenting on itself and on Google with how we can use that to kind of facilitate collaboration and sharing in ways that we couldn't have easily done before.
That's great. One last question, Ben. As you look into your crystal ball, I wonder if you could talk a bit about trends and things that particularly intrigue you looking into the future.
So, yeah, sure. Three things that I think are interesting, that I know are interesting to me, and I think will be interesting to your audience as well. Number one, browser security. Number two, Android in the enterprise. And number three, the arrival and emergence of Chrome OS. So on browser security, you know, it's important to understand that from some, I've heard some security practitioners say that a browser is a tool used to run other people's code on your computer inside your organization. And that may not be kind of a point of view that everyone shares, but I think we all have to admit that it is, in fact, realistic and that, you know, the answer isn't not to retreat from the internet and not to retreat from the web because browsers run other people's code. I do think it's important for CIOs and IT decision makers to make the best possible browser security decision they can make. It's not a decision that I believe can be made around censorship. It has to do with the security capabilities of your browser fundamentally. Now, what concerns me is I've talked to an awful lot of CIOs in the last 2 months who are midway through 9 to 18 month long browser and operating system upgrade plans. And 9 to 18 months ago, the security landscape might not have looked as threatening as it does today, and the options for browser security weren't all that they are today. Chrome is a browser that I think is fundamentally designed with security as part of the architecture in ways that older browsers weren't. And it has a plugin model, for example, and an isolation model that are just better than what you can do in many other products. But whatever the answer is for CIOs, I think the important thing is understand that your browser plans are all about the security of your company and make sure you're making a really wise, secure choice. All too often, CIOs tend to think of browsers as kind of the last thing that they're going to worry about, and they're most interested in maintaining backwards compatibility with the apps that someone wrote 10 years ago. I think that that's way less important than the security of your enterprise. The next thing I wanted to mention was this growing role of Android in the enterprise, right? And on the one hand, on smartphones, we've seen the emergence of an enterprise policy management framework for Android come out towards the end of last year, October, November. I think that's great. I think Android as an enterprise offering is great because it does what we've needed, what's happened in so many other technology spheres that we as CIOs care about, right? It's offered standardization and thus commoditization, right? Android runs on multiple hardware manufacturers' devices and multiple carriers' devices, yet it itself is a standard. And that means that we can now play correctly, get our vendors to work for us, as opposed to having to come to the vendors because they're single source offerings for particular smartphone technologies. The next thing related to that, and again, it's open, it's an open source ecosystem. It's, I think, a great possibility. I think in the long run, you get better security, you get better offerings as a result of its being open, as a result of its being standard, as a result of its being multi-vendor. I think that that's something that CIOs need to embrace. Understand it's happening. You can either be part of it or you can let it kind of sneak up on you. Don't let it sneak up on you. Then the other thing that we saw, and I think a lot of this was highlighted in these announcements at CES, is the role of Android tablets, right? And once again, I can't even count how many manufacturers announced that they had plans to support tablets. And this is clearly a new form factor that we as CIOs need to get our arms around and think about what it means for us and how we're going to standard. Do we want to standardize? Does it mean we need to think about what are, you know, changes in our development organizations? Do we need to think about a new personal productivity tool set? Do we need to reconsider the role of the laptop in our companies? These are important things to consider. These will be 2011 themes. And the third thing that I'm really excited about, I wanted to mention, Peter, is the future of Chrome operating system in the enterprise. And what so excites me about it is that there are so many of the challenges that come from traditional personal computing offerings in the enterprise are solved by Chrome, by the Chrome operating system. You know, we talked years ago about the opportunity of the network computer to kind of change the IT landscape, and it didn't really, for a bunch of reasons, it didn't really emerge. It was a great idea that was maybe too early. Chrome OS looks like it is going to deliver on these things for us. We've had Chrome OS laptops inside Google for some time as part of the way that we test our software and our offerings internally. And what excites me about it is how much simpler it is to support, about how many fewer security worries I have, about having to worry about updating a fleet of computers, about how when it's a lower cost hardware platform, about how when there are problems, you know, my support people can solve them really, you know, they reimage the machine, which takes a minute, maybe literally a minute, maybe two. If that doesn't work, they give you a new piece of hardware and you're off and running. It's the dream personal technology environment for many CIOs in terms of being able to have something that's secure. We don't have to worry about data going out the door and never coming back. It's easy to support. It's lower cost. I'm really excited about it. I think we're going to see a lot more about Chrome in the enterprise coming this year.
That's great. Very exciting indeed. Well, Ben Fried, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, Peter, thanks a lot. We'll be right back.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World-Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World-Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world-class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information about these five principles and sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metisstrategy.com. And please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metisstrategy.com. Our editor is Chris Davis, and our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.